This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Aftershock Central Podcast with Martin and Travis.
Hello.
Yes. Where's Ronnie, you ask? Don't know. Don't care. He's dead to me. Where's Jack, you ask? I don't know either. He's fired. But that's okay. Travis is here, and that's all that matters. Ain't that right?
Yeah. You know, the numbers are whittling down a little bit, so who's next? I don't know.
I mean, the only people that remained are the ones that are truly dedicated to the show. See, when I don't show up, I'm doing the Lord's work. You know what I'm saying? I'm traveling through time. I'm revising things. Okay?
Oh, like revisionist type
that's right. Well, you know,
activities?
His name was Martin. That's me.
Ah, yes. Well, there's a few Martin. We got another Martin this week as well.
Yes, we did. Boom, Ronnie, get on it. See, Ronnie was so happy because he was in one book. I'm in all the books, Ronnie.
Ronnie. Yeah, they're all referencing you as well. There's no chance that's
coincidence. No chance whatsoever.
Yeah, I ended up in a Valiant book in Secret Weapons. Secret Weapons 1, I think.
Really?
Yeah, for one panel, and then the dude's dead. Spoiler alert.
I was in Secret Weapons also.
Yes. Spoiler alert there as well.
Spoiler alert. Was Ronnie in Secret Weapons? Nope.
Not yet.
Nope. He won't be. Ronnie hates Valiant. Just like he hates Aftershock. I was hoping he'd be around, though, because I wouldn't know if there's any news. I've been so busy, I don't know if there's any news. But, I mean, I checked. I don't think so.
Not a lot of news that I remember now.
Yeah, I don't think so. So that's fine. I went on the Aftershock website. There hasn't been any news posted in, like, 3 months. So I'm just going to assume there's no news.
Yeah, well, you know, there's, like, new titles rolling out. So, you know, we have that look forward to, for, like, the next few months.
Yeah.
But, I don't know how often they announce, like new titles, you know. We're getting a lot, so maybe we'll have to wait for a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, the March solicits came out, but there was nothing really new in there either. You know what I'm saying? Because they had already announced Betrothed was announced, I think, last month or 2 months ago. And we briefly talked about that. The what's it called? Shock. The anthology hardcover book that's coming out.
Yeah.
That's coming out in March. I'm so stoked for that one, dude. Oh, my God. Anthologies are my thing. March 21st, it's on my calendar.
Dude, any chance that you have read Heavy Metal or 2000 AD?
Yep.
Yeah.
All of the above.
I've got a soft spot for those two.
Yeah, I just recently got into 2000 AD through Judge Dredd.
Yeah, that's, I think, what they're best known for.
Yeah.
It's like, it's an interesting format, and obviously, like, 2000 AD does a different way. It's like almost like a weekly publication or something, you mm-hmm. know, so they're very short stories, and it's a much shorter issue, like, versus Heavy Metal, which is, like, quarterly or something, and it's, like, it's much longer in total and, like, longer stories in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I need to read some more 2000 AD. See, so I do Comixology Unlimited, and there's like 3 or 4 volumes of Dread in there, and I just happened to pick it up. It's not the 2000 AD stuff; it's the IDW, I think, is the one that puts it out.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really good. And Humble Bundle just had a Judge Dread Humble Bundle, and I was like, "What? Like, how convenient that now that I'm reading this, you guys do a Humble Bundle?" So I got that.
Nice.
Because it was like $15 for like, I don't know, like 30 trades or something. So I couldn't pass that up. But yeah, I'm stoked for this Shock, man. There's some big names on it. And I might have talked about it on like Valiant Central. I know I talked about it on Nerd Legion a few times. Like, I keep asking publishers to do anthology series, and they always just tell me, well, they don't sell very well, so we don't have any plans to do them. And the fact that Aftershock is willing to put out an anthology just, it means a lot to me, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is not, like, written for me, but I almost feel like it is, you know? And there's big names, like Marguerite's on there, Cullen Bunn, Azzarello, Aaron Douglas, Neil Gaiman, who else is on there? Let's see, Joe's doing stuff, Jim Starlin's got a story in there, like, There's some pretty pretty big names on there. Yeah, weird, right?
That's awesome.
So I'm looking forward to it. And it's $35. I don't even know how long the book is, but with all those names, I'm assuming at least 100 pages, right? I don't know.
Yeah. It's probably in the solicit somewhere, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it should be good. I hope they continue to do it, because yeah, it's like a format that's not out there a lot, and there's definitely an audience for it.
There is,
especially if you're doing it well. That's the thing, you know. It's like, as I say, I have a soft spot for heavy metal, but like, you know, not to ruffle any feathers, like I've been trying to read recent stuff where Grant Morrison was editor-in-chief, and I can't even get through a single issue. I'm like, what the hell is this, dude? Like, so stupid. So, like, that is the thing, is you put somebody like Aftershock on it, I think you could get something that makes sense and is great to look at. You know, it's like doing it well. So I wish them success with that.
Me too. And the funny thing is, I ask a lot of people about it, and maybe just because I have, like, weird nerd friends. But everybody that I talk to that I, you know, tell them, hey, I want an anthology, they're like, yes, why don't they do a book like such and such or such and such? They're like, I buy the shit out of that. It's just the publishers don't want to take a chance because I guess my friends are weird and the general public doesn't care for anthology. But whatever.
Well, as a tangent, I know it's the wrong podcast, but somebody from the Valiant Facebook group suggested an anthology series for Valiant, like just as a kind of like destination for characters that don't have their own ongoings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's a huge response. People are like, hell yeah, dude. Like, that is such a good idea. So it's definitely, when done well, like I think that it, you know, it's easy to enjoy and get behind it.
Well, if that's the case, then I want credits in the inside cover, because I've been pitching that to Dinesh for like 3 years.
Yeah, yeah, we shall see. Good luck with that. Is that where your story is gonna debut?
Oh, dude, that story's changed so much now. Yeah, we can't talk about that.
Yeah. All right, Aftershock?
Yeah, we like that. Let's talk about that. Aftershock Comics. The best. There's we had three books last week, man. It's good stuff. We had Monster Mechanica number 2, Alters number 9, and Pestilence number 6, which is the last issue, but not the last issue. Where do you want to start? Because I know where I want to start, but you might have a different idea.
I think you should do how you want to start.
All right, fine. Let's kick off with Monster Mechanica number 2.
Nice.
And I'll do a creator roll call. And unlike Ronnie, I'm glad Ronnie's not here, because I will pronounce the names correctly this time.
Ooh, shots fired.
Shots fired. God, I think he said the names like 50 different ways. Anyways, Monster Mechanica number 2. It's written by Paul Aller with art by Chris Evenhus. We have colors by Sian Weyers and letters by Paul Aller.
Way to go,
Paul. Yeah, I didn't even realize that until I just now looked at it.
He wanted the option to do, like, last-minute changes, you know? Like, oh, no, I got a better one. I got a better one. Okay, here we go.
This is, like, completely off-topic, but I've always wondered about that. Because, you know, like, artists oftentimes will ink their own stuff, but I never see a writer lettering their own books. But it seems to me like that would make perfect sense, right? Wouldn't that be, like, kind of an extension of the writing?
Oh, well, you know, I think a lot of people write on keyboards and stuff. You know, like, lettering is such a... It really is an artistic thing.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess you're right.
And some people have crap handwriting, you know? Like, I don't know, I could do a good job lettering if I was really trying. It's like, there's something to it.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, give me a nutshell recap of this fine, fine title.
Okay, so... Having traveled to Volterra to oversee the siege, Leonardo sends Isabel and the Monstro into the city on a secret mission to find Praetor Baroni and Riario. She finds their quarry and delivers a letter to Riario, who then kills Baroni per instructions from Leonardo.
Mm-hmm.
The siege on the city begins with Isabel, Riario, and the Monstro still inside.
Nice. Yeah. I thought this issue was... 1,000 times better than the first. And I don't know if it's because there was more action or what. I just, for me, the first issue felt a little flat. And I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. It just wasn't my favorite number one. I think it had some good setup, but it wasn't my favorite number one. This second issue, though, I really, really dug it. Matter of fact, I almost wish, like, Leonardo wasn't even in this book.
He barely is, actually.
Yeah, well, yes. But I just like, what's the girl's name?
Isabel.
I really, really like her. And her interactions with the Monstro are just freaking awesome. Because I would imagine, like, as an artist, it's got to be really difficult to convey a lot of emotion in a character when that character's got no face.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Chris does a fantastic job. Like, there's that one scene where he's copying everything she does. And even without the face being there, it's almost like you can tell that this thing is alive. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm sure part of that is with the way that it's written. But obviously visualizing that on the page, I gotta give mad props to Chris for that whole page, man. I really dug it.
Yeah. You know, like, clearly, the monster is expressive, you know, and like we are getting some, you know, like kind of a human vibe off of it in much the ways that, like, the characters in the story, you know, at least like Isabel is, you know?
Yes.
And so, I mean, there was that element of the last issue where they are all referring to the monster as a he, and Leonardo makes a very strong point about, no, it's an it. It's not a, you know, it's not a thing. It doesn't think. So there, that's some of the conflict there. You know, I'm curious as far as that, I'm very interested about kind of what the parameters are of what Isabel is doing, you know?
Hmm.
Like specifically, what does Leonardo think that she is teaching him? Because, you know, like she is the one that's overseeing the robot, and he right. is very hands-off with that. And he gives her instructions about what he wants to be done. And his instructions are all, no, like, you have to give the monstro specific instructions. He can't be doing whatever he wants, you know? You can't leave it up to him to decide. And he, like I'm curious where that comes from specifically.
Hmm.
And if that is actually a prudent decision, you know, versus Isabel, who is trying to teach the monster how to think. And she doesn't necessarily seem to know how the monster should act, you know? Like, it should be her that is telling the monster what to do. She should be the one who decides, okay, you protect Leonardo or you defeat Leonardo. But she's kind of passing that responsibility along to the machine.
Well, don't you feel... So, I mean, this brings up a few other things, which I've kind of been wondering about this. Because all this is wrapped in, like, this medieval story of Da Vinci. But at the same time, I wonder how much of it is about, like, what it is to, like, dealing with technology now. And maybe that's just, like, me transposing my own ideas into the book. Because I'm reading a lot about, like, AI and things like that. And, you know, I'm a huge sci-fi fan. And so I wonder, like, how much of that is trying to figure out those ideas in this setting that is centuries in the past. Because it almost feels to me like Monstro is sentient, but he's still very much a child because he was just created. And it's Isabel's role to kind of guide him into how to learn how to properly use his consciousness. And kind of, let's just say grow up, just to use a simpler term. But kind of, like, teach him what it is to be alive, I guess, in some ways. Whereas Da Vinci doesn't want that, right? Because he's creating technology simply as a tool. But at the same time, like, maybe that tool has gotten away from its original intent. And has now become something more.
Well, I think that begs the question about what is the intent, you know, what was the Monstro built for? And we really don't have any indication yet, you know? Like, if it's just a weapon, you know, but it's a weapon that's so special that only he is going to have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that, you can then ask the question about, you know, like, what level of intelligence do you need for something that's a weapon, you know?
Hmm.
And, you know, like, I think I mentioned before, there's maybe in kind of a loose analogy with, like, the Flacco character in War Mother.
Oh, right.
Which is also a sentient weapon. And comes from, you know, an environment where they used to wipe the memory every single time a mission was over, which I think is what's supposed to be happening with the Monstro, right? Like,
right.
Monstro isn't really supposed to have a lingering identity. Like, he's supposed to be fresh out the box every single time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like, what exactly is the role of intelligence? Like, it may not have even been intended or designed that, like, this monster was gonna, at some point, be able to think for itself.
Right.
So it's like a byproduct.
Well, no, I don't think that's the case at all, right? Because I don't feel like that would be the way, I mean, if you have some religious views that will differ from what I'm about to say, then I apologize, but I'm gonna say it anyway. you know, it's like, When people gain consciousness, right? And I mean, I could talk about some of the weird things that I've heard on the evolution of that. From like the way that the Odyssey was written, for example, until much later in Greek mythology, the way myths were told, and then going forward in human history. But like people weren't like designed to be conscious, right? There's like certain aspects of the way that we evolved from whatever we evolved from, that over time gave us different tools that eventually led us to becoming conscious and self-aware. And I feel like that is the same argument we could have about Monstro, and I mean, really any robots now or like artificial intelligences, going into the future, where you don't design it to be self-aware. There's things that happen that ultimately it just so happens that things click together and they become self-aware, right?
So it's an accident.
Yeah, it purely by accident.
Yeah, but it is voice command, you know? It is very much like, hey, Monstro, go punch that guy, you know, and it goes and does it. So it's an accidental outgrowth of that kind of functionality, right?
Sure. Sure, well, among other things. And actually, that's interesting that you brought that up, because even Isabel, when she's having that whole conversation with him about when he needs to follow her orders and when he doesn't, and he's copying everything she does, there was one point later in the issue where she tells him to do something, and he obeys. Oh, when she goes up to the top of the tower, right? And then she tells him to stay where he's at, that she'll be right back, she's gotta do whatever her mission is. But then towards the end, when the siege starts, if it wasn't for the Monstro disobeying her order to stay where he was at, she probably would have been killed in the tower.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like that by itself kind of gives you a hint that, like, yes, he is built to follow orders, but at the same time, like, maybe it's more important for him to, you know, like Asimov's, the laws of robotics, you know, like you don't harm a human or whatever. It's almost like he's instinctually, creating those rules in his head where, like, yes, he'll obey whatever he's told to do unless those things disobey the prime directive, whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, ultimately he needs to keep her safe. But what's interesting is why he might feel that way, because maybe he thinks of her as a friend and not just somebody to bark orders at him like Leonardo would do.
Or there may even be kind of a maternal bond or something, you know,
sure,
like a parental bond.
Yep.
But I mean, I gotta say, I'm kind of curious, like what Leonardo, is after in all this, you know, like, there's certainly intrigue there. Like,
yeah.
You know, he sends them into the city like, ostensibly, what, to kill the praetor who's, like, the head of the city or something?
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I find that interesting in the context of everything else that is going on. So, I'm guessing he's trying to take over Volterra, right? And maybe he is working both sides, the Medici's versus the Pope's. But what his ultimate endgame is, I think that is interesting and elusive.
All right, so that's an interesting question I hadn't thought about. Because I was just under the assumption that he just works for the Medici's.
Yeah, well, he at the beginning of the issue, I think, the priest dude from the last issue, like sent a clockwork bird with a message that said, like, we got Leonardo, basically, and that gets delivered to the Pope. So they know that, like, now Leonardo is assumedly coming over to their side. But I think it's interesting in the context of another scene in this issue where basically, like, Leonardo seems to be kind of like plotting or something, and like seeing the stuff unfold, and Machiavelli is there and he's like, I'm really not as vicious as they say, like Machiavelli is like, dude, Leonardo, like, you're stone cold. I feel like what he's known for, his legacy, the prince and all that,
yeah,
is coming from Leonardo. He's just taking notes right now, and he's like, god damn, dude, like, he is ruthless and he's trying to take over the world.
Yeah.
There's something going on, right? And I don't know if they are going to go with what they telegraphed as far as, like, a showdown at some point between the Monstro and Leonardo.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't.
It's a little early to speculate.
Yeah. Well, is it? What is this? 4 issues? 5 issues? Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, ultimately, I expect the Monstro to kind of go off with Isabel. But I mean, in terms of Leonardo, I am more curious about what the ulterior motive is. And I kind of want to know, like, what the time frame is on this. Is there, have we seen a date? I haven't really been paying attention to dates.
Yeah, I looked it up. And it was like, I want to say 1472 is like what they say at the beginning of the first issue.
Okay.
Which is, like about 60 years before, The Prince was first published.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cause I mean, Leonardo was working for the Medici's in that time. I didn't even look up Machiavelli. Maybe I should.
Yeah.
It was funny. I was doing some, I was listening to some podcasts this week and they were talking about Michelangelo and, he was supported by the Medici's as well. And it got me thinking about this book a little bit, but God, I can't believe I didn't look up Machiavelli.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's yet to be seen whether he'll actually have a real role to play in this, or if he's just kind of there for, like, the kind of reasons we discuss, Whether he's kind of just like it's going to come out that the prince is a story about Leonardo or something. I was also wondering, as far as this issue playing out, he sends Isabel and the Monstro in for this mission, it then becomes a question of, like, he doesn't give him a lot of time to do the mission, and then it becomes a question of, like, well, what, you're gonna start the assault on the city while they're still inside?
Sure.
I thought that was kind of strange, like, for me, there's a question of whether he wants her to come back from the mission, or whether since she was sent on basically like an assassination errand, like whether he would prefer that she didn't come back.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too. Because she sends him to get that guy who gets killed per his orders, and then the siege starts. He tries to hold off on the siege, right? They just kind of start without him. So maybe he thought that it was a possibility that she would die there. But I don't necessarily think that was his plan.
Yeah, I was just a little confused about the way that was playing out,
Yeah.
And, like, why you would send her in on this mission when like, what was the purpose of that assassination, especially when they're about to, like take the city?
Sure.
So what is the Praetor whatever know that, like, would have been damaging if it had gotten out? What, was he silenced for some reason?
Well, or maybe the siege is just kind of a cover for the assassination.
Yeah, I mean, seems unnecessary then, because they... I mean, well, the siege was already ongoing, so maybe he just kind of insinuates himself into the siege to do this thing and then get out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's possible. That is possible. All right, you want to rate this one up?
Yeah, dude. I think I'm going to go 5 out of 5.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like this series, and especially I think the art is beautiful. Both the lines and the colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's definitely a lot of meaty story stuff, sci-fi stuff, intrigue, historical stuff. So I'm digging it.
Yeah, I'm gonna give this one a 4.33257. I really dug it. I like this time period, and I love Leonardo. I love Machiavelli. Was one of like the first books that I read, the Prince. So yeah, like on my own, you know what I'm saying? Like, outside of school, like, you know, growing up, you go to school, you have to read books. But the Prince was one of those books where, like, I went out. God, I can't remember. I was pretty young too. I was like 12 or 13. And I was like, This sounds awesome. Let me learn about, like, war tactics, kind of. It was really interesting. So I'm going to give this... Oh, I already did.
You already did, yeah.
4.33267. Yeah, I loved it. And, yeah, you're right. The art is freaking... It's amazing. It's almost, like, minimal, but there's a lot going on the page at the same time. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that the book is colored, because it almost seems subdued... I don't even know how to explain it. Anyway, let's move on. I'm not an art critic. Let's continue.
I'm with you. By the way, shout out to that Burning Man looking scene where the dude was naked on a bonfire. I like that.
Nice. Naked dude next? On the bonfire, episode title. I don't know. You pick this time.
You want to do Altars next?
Sure. Altars number 9. It's Paul Jenkins, Lee Elise on art, Leonardo Pacioretty on colors, and Ryan Hill on letters. Give me the nutshell, buddy.
All right. So, Charisse accompanies the other Altars on a mission to save Latavius from his kidnappers. During the mission, the baddies are defeated, but Charisse is blown through a quantum exit and separated from the team while Latavius discovers his own alteration.
Hmm. All right, then. So, if I'm not mistaken, this is the second to last issue.
I believe you're correct, yeah.
Yeah. Which is sad, because I really love this book. I have since it came out. It gives me that vibe that I used to get reading the X-Men back in the days, you know? We're like, yeah, it's about people with superpowers, but, like, what does that mean to these people, and what does it mean to the world in general? And it's almost like... like watching a soap opera unfold in a comic book form. You know what I'm saying? A soap opera for angsty young teenage boys. But it really works. And I've loved the series throughout, so I'm kind of sad that it's going to be going away. Although maybe they'll do like season 2, like they're doing with all the other stuff, you know? I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, for sure.
But there's some, there's a lot of really touching moments here. I mean, from the very beginning, all the way to the end, because we really learn a lot about Chalice and her relationship with, oh man, what's his name? Dang it. Bring your notes out! Morph. There you go. We learn about how they were friends from before they had superpowers, because they used to work together. They were childhood friends, if I'm not mistaken. They went to, like, kindergarten together. So they've known each other their whole lives. And we get a few pages of when... Charles told, I can't remember his real name either, but told Morph about the time when he was gonna do the sex change, and start transitioning into a woman. And, I thought that was interesting, because I've never seen that in a comic book either, right? I mean, I think I've seen it on TV a few times, My wife loves watching some like Lifetime and whatever all those channels are. And so I've seen these kind of stories before, but it was cool seeing it in a comic. And it was awesome seeing that it wasn't, the experience wasn't denigrated in any way, you know? And I think it's important because, Travis, let me tell you, social media ruins the internet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, people bitch and complain all the time about comics. Like, well, like, you can't write a comic about, I don't know, whatever. Let's pick a Black Widow. You can't write Black Widow comic because you're a 60-year-old man. And what do you know about being a 30-year-old Russian woman? And, like, you hear that stuff all the time, right? Like, oh, the white guy, he can't write black characters. And, I mean, this is Paul Jenkins, right? He's a British white dude. And he's writing this book with really strong minority characters. And obviously a very strong transgender character. And for me, like, this book on its own throws all those arguments away. Because it's so touching and so moving. And so Paul Jenkins really makes everything in this book just so personal and personable, that I really, really dig it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, dude. His handling of, you know, as you say, kind of both the, you know, writing for different races and kind of socioeconomic class. Also, you know, the whole transgender issue, I think, has been expert. And, you know, like, you're talking about the X-Men, right? You know, like, originally, I think arguably they started out as a metaphor for, you know, racial discrimination. You know, around the turn of the century, Bryan Singer came along and turned it into a powerful message for, you know, homosexuality, you know, like that became the metaphor. You know, like Iceman and X2, like, have you tried not being a mutant? Here they're doing the same metaphor, but for transgender.
Sure.
And I think it's fascinating because, you know, so much talk in this series throughout has been about identity and alterations, about, like, you discover who you are, you mm-hmm. know? And, you know, like, that is where I think the analogy metaphor works better than, you know, homosexuality, maybe, because you're talking about, like these people transform. They're not the same as they were before they found out who they are,
yep.
often via Chalice. And I thought that the scene where he's coming out to his friend, I agree, it's, like, powerful. And what I thought was the most interesting part was when he's like, all right, so we're being real, right? Because, like, I always thought you were gay, you know, and I never thought what was going on, right? It's like his oldest fucking friend in the world. And they never talked about it once. Not a topic of conversation. And that rings true, dude. Like, I don't know. There's people in my life who, you know, like, you know, there was a sense, maybe, you know, like amongst friends or whatever, you know, like kind of a, like, I wish they would come out of the closet, you know?
Right.
Like,
right.
They're like, why are they doing this? Like, they would be so much happier or whatever. And, you know, like, eventually that happens, you know, but you can't broach the subject, you know, that's not your, you know, like, topic to introduce.
No, absolutely. So
I thought that was a powerful thing to be like, oh man, dude, like I haven't seen anything like that in a comic book.
Well, and the cool thing too was that, Charles was kind of joking about it, right? Cause when he's like, yeah, I thought it was that you're gay. And he's like, well, I am gay. He's like, I'm a woman and I like women. I'm just in a man's body. Like, that whole thing was really interesting. And yeah, I mean, like, I think we've all had those friends, right? Where you, like, wonder, like, dude, just, if you're gay, just come out as you're gay, or, you know, whatever the hell else it is. But I think it seems to me that that's a tough decision, because not only do they have to wrestle with whatever they're feeling, but also with whatever roles they feel they should be assigned. And I think obviously a lot of that's going away now with modern culture. Although, I mean, you could argue with our current political climate, maybe some of that stuff is going backwards as well. But you feel like you should be a certain way based on the way society treats you, right? And it's almost like, I feel like you're the same way that I am, right? So like, if I had a friend who I felt was gay, like, I would wonder, well, dude, like, just fucking tell me, right? Like, I'm here for you regardless, I'm your friend, right? So just get it over with, come out, tell me. I'm still gonna be your friend, but let me help you along with this whole thing. But like, on my side, like, I couldn't say that to somebody, because what if I'm just completely wrong, right? Or what if it's true, but they feel attacked because I'm saying something like that, right?
It just can't be done, dude.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's not the way it works.
Rough. So yeah, that whole thing was really pretty awesome. Really pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then we just kind of get back to the superhero stuff. Morph, like, sends out his little body parts to this warehouse to see, like, what the hell's going on, so they can teleport in there and kick some ass. And oh, God, what's the girl's name? The black lady, the teleporter.
Charisse,
that's right. He's doing some recon to see, like, what Charisse is, what her kid is up to, what the kidnappers are up to. And, like, even he's going through that, right? Because, like, he's about to die, and he has decided that he needs to do this transformation because it's the right thing for everybody else, right? Like, he wants to be helpful. And if he stays in the hospital, he's not going to be. And I think we talked about this when issue 8 came out, and I don't think you were on that particular episode yet. But it's really interesting how what the parallel is to these characters' real lives, right? And I think that's something we don't often see in superhero comics, period. You often see just the hero side, and you tend to forget, like, these people need to eat lunch, or they need to go to the bathroom and pee, right? Like, they gotta go home at some point and go to sleep. They're not just always fighting crime. And I think Morph is a really good example of that here. He wants to do the right thing. And he's still learning about himself, even though he doesn't have much time left to use his powers. He's like, yeah, I've been trying this thing out where I just, like, let a little piece of me go, and I can use it as, like, a little spy drone thing. And I like that whole thing as well.
Well, yeah, and I was wondering about that, because clearly he's discovering new abilities. Like, might that not be an avenue towards him fixing himself, you know? Like, couldn't he just assemble a version of himself, like, in another place that doesn't have the broken neck or whatever, you know? Mm. So I was curious about that, but it doesn't, you know, take away from, obviously, like, the emotional impact of that whole exchange, and basically he's, you know, taking back control after, you know, a chaotic accident, you know, came in and kind of wrecked his life. You know, and he made a tough choice, but I can imagine the existential horror of lying in a hospital bed paralyzed for your whole life, especially when you lived as a hero and could do it again,
right.
You know?
Right.
That's a little bit tough to give up, I would imagine.
Yep.
But okay, so I was wondering about some stuff, right? Like, basically how, like, what the plan is that we're seeing from Matterman. That's like Matterman's henchmen, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Nine and his crew, yeah.
Right? So my assumption, basically, is that they're trying to bust Matterman out, and that Charisse is the key to it, because she can do the portal thing.
Yep.
You know? Like, in this issue, Nine makes a few comments that are largely to the effect of, like, the child is everything, he's important, you know, gotta protect the child. But my assumption, ultimately, was that the kid was leveraged to get Charisse to do what they want, bust Matterman out, and I think showdown between him and Chalice is what's gonna be the final issue.
So I was curious about that as well, because I thought the same thing until the last page, and then it made me wonder if Matterman and Nine and his cult crew didn't know that Latavius had some kind of abilities already. where Charisse and Chalice and their whole crew did not know, and whether maybe that was the plan all along, was Latavius, not so much Charisse.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's kind of up in the air, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the last issue, right, that's when Charisse got, or that's when Latavius got kidnapped. Like, they confront her in a parking lot, and, like it's kind of like, hey, you want to work for us, right? You know, like, and I feel like that was directed toward Charisse and not as much toward Latavius at the time.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I mean, it could be, but I don't know that the totally not Cyclops-like eyeblasty thing is gonna bust through whatever. Like that's gonna bust Matterman out in a way that you know something else couldn't.
Well, I mean, we just assume that it's a Cyclops-C type thing because he's got lasers coming out of his eyes. So, I mean, and it could be, but at the same time, like at the end, I don't know, man. It could still go either way. Because at the end, Charisse falls into her own portal, and the portal's closing.
See, I don't think that was her portal.
Oh, really?
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, like, my take on that, because I was very curious what was going on with that, because they call it a quantum exit, I believe.
Right.
Right? And it's like, you see Nine or whatever sit down at a keyboard and punch some buttons, and this portal opens up.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yep, you're right. I see it now.
But I was interested in the portal because A, Morph can go and like hold it open physically with his arms.
Yeah, right.
Which is like, yeah, classic portal behavior. You know, also then like what Charisse does, like she's inside the portal and then she just makes people disappear while they're also inside the portal.
Hmm.
Do you remember that? Like she does something and like the two bad guys disappear, and then she talks to Latavius, and she's like, I had to do it, honey.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, because they go in, there, she runs in after them.
Yeah, like, they're in the portal when that's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wonder what that was about, because it's not very explained very well either. Like, her hands light up, and then she's like, what the hell? And they're gone, like, within two panels. So, yeah, that's weird. Okay, so it's not her portal, so that makes me think now even less that she's not the target after all, that it really is Latavius.
Yeah, I think it's a tough call at this point, right? Yeah, so we'll see in the next issue whether they still are trying to get Latavius back or whether, you know, like, he was just a means to an end and now they don't need him anymore.
Yep. Agreed. All right, let's rate this one up. I'll go first on this one, and for me, it's a 4.5 out of 5. I love Alters. I'm very sad it's going away.
Yes, I'm right there with you, 4.5 out of 5, and hopefully there might be room for a season 2 at some
point. I would love that. All right, last book of the night, Pestilence, number 6, Death Ends. This is Frank Thierry writing, who, by the way, he's taking over Palmiotti on Harley Quinn. I had no idea. Oleg Okunev on art. Got a bunch of story thing on here. Frank Thierry, Brandon Oman, Eric Bromberg. Colors by Rob Schwaggy P. Schwager. And letters by Marshall Dillon. You have a nutshell recap for me on this one?
Yeah, I've got a nutshell on this one, but it's a little bit shaky. So
I like shaky.
Yeah, you know, apologies. And you can correct if it's a little bit off base.
As long as it's not stirred, we're good to go.
Yes, well, maybe slightly. Okay, so Roderick and crew fight their way into Westminster Abbey, discover a secret passage that contains the Holy Grail. They take the Grail into a well, which causes a giant water spout and a storm of holy water that cures the zombies. Domenico tries and fails to kill Roderick and Fiat Lux. Shaw then arrives and abandons his mission to help Roderick unravel the conspiracy. In the aftermath, Price capitalizes on the chaos and miraculous salvation to become the new pope. Roderick is on the run and sends his written account of the events to his wife Jacqueline and gives the Grail to Shaw, who travels the world saving the zombies.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good nutshell.
Dude, that's like the longest nutshell I've ever done because definitely, I mean, it's, I think probably partially a symptom of that there's like this little epilogue at the end that's like, right. Oh, and then all this other crazy shit happens that I guess you could say like setting up season two, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. So, yeah, I thought it was interesting. I am very kind of curious. I'm a little bit shaky, I think, on what is the conspiracy, right? Because, like, you know, Roderick's on the run. He had to send this written account to his wife who's like, don't believe what you hear about me because, like, the church is trying to kill me because I know too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the conspiracy, as I understand it, is that, you know, this kind of zombie plague happens through evil forces, like the devil caused it or something. And the church covered it up as it was happening because they didn't want to take away from Jesus and his miraculous return from the grave.
Sure.
So they covered it up, I guess, while knowing full well that they had the grail that would fix the problem. Is that the conspiracy?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, because the grail was kind of a MacGuffin, right?
Well, the grail is, like, dude who dies in the previous issue, like, kind of tells them as he's dying, he's like, you need to go to Westminster Abbey and, you know, like, find the word of God, and that's gonna fix things. Like, they don't just stumble on it, they are led there specifically. So that implies prior knowledge that that would work, I think.
Hmm.
Or maybe... like, he just knows about that, and, like, that's his like, Hail Mary, no pun intended.
So, what I'm more curious about is what the actual cause of the outbreak was. Because it seems to me like this could end up being much more than just what it is on the surface. And I could be totally reading, like, really deep into this, you know what I'm saying? Because according to the book, the origin was something about the devil, and the devil started this plague and whatever. And that could very well be. But then, like, when the grail shows up... Alright, I think what the problem is I really love this series. And I thoroughly enjoyed this last issue, so don't get me wrong when I say this. But it's almost too easy for them to just find this holy grail that magically just cures the zombie plague, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to know, like, did the devil really start this plague? Is the grail, like, just the cup that shoots water out of it? You know what I'm saying? Like, I want it to be more than just something that simple. But it seems like on the surface that's kind of just what it is. The church is corrupt. The devil's like, F you, church, you guys suck. Here's the zombie plague. And this magical artifact just comes out of nowhere to save the world. And in many respects, I'll be honest with you, that kind of bothers me, if that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certain things about the way that it read, especially in the conclusion, you know, like, the way that they portray Price rising to power and being like, oh, well, he took credit for, like, the zombie plague going yeah. away. And it's like... when they do that kind of thing, like in the movies or something, my reading more often than not tends to be like, oh, well, so this is a crisis that they caused so they could fix it and then use that to rise to power.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So if that is what they're going for, I mean, that would be nice. You know, because that kind of further underlines why they feel that they need to eliminate anybody who knows anything about it.
Yeah. If that is ultimately the case, and I like the way you're thinking right now, then that makes me feel a little bit better, because I do like the conspiracy aspect of it. And I think that would tie in very well with a lot of the stuff that we've seen throughout this series. So maybe the problem is I'm focusing on the wrong thing. But I do like that, the new Pope. That was ultimately the whole conspiracy. But, like, do you think he was powerful, like, enough to set all these events into motion before being the Pope?
Well, I could see, you know, again, other examples in, you know, literature where, you know, like, it's there's really, like, a guy behind a guy, you know, like it's the advisor. It's Jafar or whatever who is, yeah. like, really pulling the strings.
Right.
And, you know, like, Zombie Pope was just, like, duped, you know? It's a little bit of a stretch, but I'm kind of curious if there is going to be a season two about where it could be headed, you know? Because, like, seems like, among other things, one of the directions they could go is, like, okay, now Roderick is trying to, you know, like, get to the bottom of the conspiracy or whatever, you know? Like, clear his name, you know, and bring the guilty to justice.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of, I feel like that might not be the direction either, because they make a lot out of this journal that he's sending to Jacqueline, who I'm curious if she has direct contacts to Fiat Lux. She's like, long live Fiat Lux.
Yeah, right.
If it's her that's going to be the agent that does something with this, or it's going to be his son, you know, who we see as a baby, and it's like, oh, well, like, when the son comes of age, like, what, he'll clear my name? You know, like, that's got to wait a while for that to pay off. Like, Price is going to be dead by that point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. But, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really matter, right? Because Fiat Lux isn't just like them. It's been an organization that's been around for a long time, and they would still be around after he's gone, after they're all gone, right? So maybe it is the son that's going to set things right. And you got to remember too, like, this would have been a different time, so a different way of thinking, where, like, even if they're already gone, dead and gone, if his son can, you know, overthrow this Pope that set this whole thing in motion, they would still regain their honor by that happening, right? Even if they're not around anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, depending, if you gotta wait for the son to grow up, by that time everybody has forgotten. Like, they may have forgotten there was a zombie plague, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's gonna have the impact if they confront the Pope and they'd be like, you framed Sir Roderick or whatever of Fiat Lux, and be like, who? Dude, we haven't heard of for 20 years.
Well, okay. But I mean, like, he's not the only one there, right? Because what's the cardinal's name that was sent to kill Roderick?
Shaw?
Shaw. I mean, Shaw's there. It almost seems like Shaw never bought into the fact that Roderick and the Fiat were traitors either, right? Because as soon as he shows up, he's like, yeah, I was sent here to kill you, but, like, we're friends now. Let me help you.
He's like, actually, I'm just going to save him, and I know that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Shaw's interesting, right? Because he ends up with the Grail, right?
Right.
And basically, he's, like, now traveling, you know, indeterminate distances, curing zombies from the plague.
Sure.
You think the church is going to want the Grail back at some point?
Well, I mean, obviously, they can't have the Holy Grail not be in possession of the church.
Yeah, I mean, he is arguably still with the church, kind of, maybe. I don't know exactly what his loyalties are at this point. Sure. I feel like they implied he also has some Knights Templar connection as well.
Yes, yes.
So maybe the Grail is with the Templars?
I mean, that would make sense, right? Historically, isn't that what the deal is?
You probably know better than I. Did the Holy Grail exist?
I mean, it depends who you ask. It's never been proven to exist, but it has been, like, there's a bunch of legends about the Grail, and it's my understanding that the Templars did have the Grail. Now what the Grail is depends on who you ask, right? So here it's the chalice, which is what generally is assigned to as being the Grail. The chalice that held the blood of Christ when he was crucified. Then you have, like, the other school that has the Holy Grail as a descendant of Christ. Either way, the Templars were in charge of protecting it.
Isn't that, like, Da Vinci Code?
Yes.
That's the wrong comic, dude. We already talked about Monstro Mechanica.
Well, actually, the Da Vinci Code thing was a thing back in the 70s, before the Da Vinci Code came out, so.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, my favorite thing about this book, and I almost wish, like, they would have found a way to keep it this way, is the fact that they carry James around, like, all over the place, and he's bound and gagged, because obviously he's a zombie, but because he's their friend, they don't want to kill him. And they just, like, tote him around, and, like, kill some guys, and there's James just hanging out, like, all bound and gagged, until, obviously, the Grail waters make him human again. I almost wish, like, they would have just kept him as a zombie, you know? And when this comes back for season two, like, there's just James hanging out like a zombie.
Like a nice zombie? Like...
Sure, whatever. It doesn't even have to be a nice zombie, but he's kind of like comedic relief in some ways.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. I like that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of came out of left field. I wasn't expecting it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about this end thing. I almost feel like maybe we've got the conspiracy all wrong, to be honest with you. Because it mentions about the conspiracy growing larger and larger even after this Pope is gone. So I almost feel like maybe that's not what this is referring to. But let's talk about the journal and the wife and the kid. By the way, I'm pretty sure there's like little baby penis in one of these panels.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
All right, it wasn't just me then. That's good to know. How did you feel about the way that this issue ended?
I have to say, I don't know if you picked up on it, but I believe that the kind of written thing from Roderick to Jacqueline that we read here,
yeah,
I believe is actually the same language verbatim from how they introduced the series in issue one.
Huh. I think you might be right.
I believe, which, you know, like, I guess begs the question, you know, like, I on some level, I'm curious about when all of this was written. Like, if it was all written in retrospect, and, like, if he could have started and ended with the same language, or if in the context of telling this story, you know, he was writing it as the adventure was happening and finishes with this piece that's, like, don't believe what they say about me, you know, like, I'm leaving it to you to, like, to carry on and clear my name, whether that's just like the end and they chose to lead with that in the first issue for dramatic purposes.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what the time frame of this is. Because I wonder if this final scene isn't taking place even before Roderick is successful. And I know that seems weird because we see them stop the plague. But the fact that it seems to me like she's in hiding, right? Yeah, I mean, she could very well be in hiding from the church, because, you know, if they're looking for Roderick, they would try to find her first, maybe, to get him out. But I wonder if maybe she isn't just still in hiding from the plague. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. She almost seems like more of a badass than Roderick is also, right? Just from that, like, that last panel, that look she gives when she's looking out the window. It just gave me this feeling that she is going to be a huge part of the story, going forward. And maybe we're not really going to see Roderick anymore for season two.
Yeah. It feels like a passing the torch.
Yep.
On some level. So who's getting the torch, you know, cause the son is also significant. Like I don't know that they needed to like show baby penis if like the son wasn't somehow going to be a relevant part of what's going to happen with this journal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, she's like, seems like she's like down with Fiat Lux, you know?
Absolutely.
It's interesting given what a big deal they seem to make about, was it Abel? Like the other girl that was in the group?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The girl that was a guy that was a girl.
Yeah, that they're like, oh, you know, like, what a shocking thing, you know? Like, that's not a Fiat Lux, that's not normal for them, mm-hmm. or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, well, I guess we'll see, you know, like obviously the church is corrupt. So we can only speculate about what they're setting up here, you know,
mm-hmm.
and timeline wise, it's still like a pretty good jump until like, you know, the days of Martin Luther or something. Right.
Right. Right.
There's still a few hundred years there, so I don't know what they could be setting up in the story.
Yep. Awesome. Let's rate it up. I love Pestilence. 5 out of 5. 16 out of 5 for me.
Wow, dude. That's very enthusiastic.
I just love this book, dude. You know me and zombies. If it's got zombies in it, it's like automatic A+.
Oh, okay. So any book with zombies, you're 5 out of 5?
Yeah. except Walking Dead. That's a 0 out of 5.
All right, good. Yeah, I mean, I got to agree that, like I'm very interested in this as far as what's obvious. It's like an obvious genre mashup, you know?
Mm.
Like the zombie and also like a knight's crusade, you know, sword and sorcery type thing. So putting those two together in a historical context that actually has some kind of, you know, dates and figures and names in it, I think it's interesting. You know, it's... I guess I'm not really sure exactly where they're going with it,
mm-hmm.
how much you should take away. You know, it's not just about zombies.
Sure.
Like, the zombies really kind of, with all that's happening in this issue especially, like, really feel like kind of a minor part, you know? And I don't know if we'd expect they'd be in the next season, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it is. The zombies come back and Roderick's kid has to fix it or something, you know? But we'll see. I think I would go maybe like 3.75 out of 5 on this.
Right.
I enjoy it, but like I don't know necessarily that it's like the deepest read out of like the Aftershock line.
No, but it's absolutely not the deepest read. But it's, to me, one of the most fun to read. And I think maybe I just read this book at the right time all the time, because I generally try to follow it with something that's a little bit more hard-hitting and requires a little more complex thought. And then I read this, and I'm like, hell yeah! Let me keep reading comics, because I just had a bunch of fun. You know what I'm saying? By the way, I don't give automatic A-pluses to all zombie things, but I do love zombie things. All right, I think that's it. We're done.
Yeah, we did it.
We did it. Screw you, Ronnie.
Come back soon, Ronnie.
I was looking at the schedule. All I see for next week is Brilliant Trash number 3. Oh, I should say maybe this week, because I think this will be out like the week that Brilliant Trash comes out.
Yeah, I think that'll work.
Yeah. Anyway, so just one book next week. So we might skip. Maybe we should skip and wait till the next week and do a couple of books at once. I don't know. We'll see. Depends how things go this week.
No, dude, we're going to do a full hour on Brilliant Trash number 3. Let's do it.
You've been listening to the Aftershock Central podcast with myself and Travis. Travis is found on Twitter at The Great Magnet. I'm at Geekvine. Ronnie is unavailable. And Jack is at Jack Sutherland. And if you want to email us, aftershockpod@gmail.com is the email address. And be sure to head out to nerdlegion.com for tons of other comic books and other types of podcasts. We'll catch you guys next week. Bye-bye.